I'm sitting here at Enchanted Grounds in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, which is a great place. And I'm sitting here with Matt. My name is Patrick. Your name's Matt.
My name is indeed Matt.
Yes. And we last spoke at WorldCon, which was an interview that our listeners don't actually get to hear because you and I decided to do another one.
Yeah. Which, you know, really, folks are probably not missing much.
Well, there was some fear on my part that the WorldCon interviews were getting a little stale.
Uh-huh.
So I just thought, at first I contacted you about doing something on Skype. You happen to be in town, so here we are sitting face-to-face again.
That works.
So, Matt, why don't you tell, from what I understand, there's like this internet rumor that you write stuff. Is that true?
I can confirm that rumor.
Okay.
Yeah,
what do you write?
What do I write? Well, I write, I'm kind of all over the place with science fiction and fantasy and horror. You know, I've written like I was a writers of the future winner in 2009, and that was a science fiction story called Gone Black. It was in volume 25, and you know, I've also written some fairly dark horror pieces. Like it was a piece that recently came out in the Galactic Medicine Show, which was among the darker things I've ever written. So I'm kind of all over the place as far as that goes. It's been mostly short stories and longer, up to novellas that have been published at this point. I've got a few novels under my belt that I'm still looking to sell or what have you. But I've got a novella that will be coming out here probably May. Early May is what I'm told. It will be in volume 3 of Alembical. And Alembical is it's an anthology series put out by Paper Golem, and it is dedicated exclusively to novellas, which I think is a really great thing because I've called the novella kind of the no man's land of publishing.
Yes.
It's
difficult to get published.
Very difficult.
Unless
you self-publish it. And that was pretty much these were pretty much my options when I finished writing this story. I knew it was going to be, you know, close to about 40,000 words in length, and that is really a no man's land. Even for magazines that say they'll publish novellas, they usually won't go much above 25,000 words. And no publisher is going to look at something as short as 40,000 words, generally speaking. It's just the economics of scale. Economies of scale just aren't there.
It's that weird little...
Yeah, it's just this. It's kind of like this dead zone. And so my options, I knew when I wrote it, my options were either going to be Alembical or self-publishing.
Gotcha.
So that's what I ended up doing. I sent it to Lawrence Schoen over at Paper Golem, and he and his co-editor Buck Housen, we did a lot of work on it. Actually, there was a fair amount of back and forth on it, which made it, to my mind, a better story. And away we go, and that should be out early May, is what he told me. So,
okay.
There we go.
Don't mind me taking notes and looking at stuff. I know it can be distracting. This is one of the reasons why I don't do a lot of these face-to-face, but hey, outside of a convention. Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to get into this? I mean, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, that's not normal for a lot of mothers, you know?
No one's ever accused me of being normal, so that's okay. I have been into science fiction, fantasy, horror since I was a kid. There was a story that I read I can't even remember how old I was. I was maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. I read it. I was in grade school, and there's a little grade school readers that you get. And there was a story in there by Ray Bradbury called The Foghorn. And it's, you know, it's a classic Ray Bradbury story. Now, as a kid, I was big into dinosaurs.
Okay.
And if you've ever read The Foghorn, this is a story about a couple of guys who are manning a lighthouse one night.
Okay.
The lighthouse summons a dinosaur from the depths. And so when that happened, I was like, oh man, this is like the coolest thing ever. So,
well, now, did you see the dinosaurs and the dragons behind you on the shelf?
The dinosaurs, I actually haven't, because they're right behind me.
Yeah. They got them mixed.
Yeah, they do have them mixed, which, you know, purists might argue with. I'm not that much of a purist, but I do love me some dinosaurs still to this day, so that's all good. I mean, seriously, when I was a kid, I was a dinosaur fanatic. I mean, I knew all the dinosaurs. You name a dinosaur, I could tell you what its name meant.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell you whether it was a Triassic, Jurassic, or Cretaceous animal. I knew everything about dinosaurs.
When dinosaurs kind of started getting into pop culture a little bit more, and you had mm-hmm. Jurassic Park and all that, were you excited or were you like, oh no?
I was a little of both.
Okay.
I was a little of both. I thought it was kind of cool that more people were getting into it. But at the same time, you kind of have that kind of hipster attitude. It's like, you guys are just now late to the party. I've been into this for the past 30 years. And it's interesting to me, as someone who has been into dinosaurs for a long time,
mm-hmm.
it was interesting to me just how much what we know about dinosaurs has changed. When I was a kid, we all knew that dinosaurs were cold-blooded animals.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that. We knew they were dumb. We knew they were lumbering, slow-moving things. We knew that Brachiosaurus was probably so heavy that he had to spend most of his life buried pretty much up to his head in a swamp because the water would support his weight. We knew these things mm-hmm. to be true. You understand?
Right.
And then we've since learned that dinosaurs can be warm-blooded or likely warm-blooded creatures, that they probably weren't as dumb as a lot of people thought they were.
Right.
They were faster moving and all of this. That kind of thing fascinates me.
Did you see the new one that they're talking about now, the dino bird / dragon?
No, I don't know that I have.
Okay.
You
need to look that up.
I do. I will.
Yes.
The dino bird dragon.
Yes.
I'm down with dragons, too. Don't get me wrong.
So you read the Bradbury story.
Uh-huh.
What happens next?
Well, and even then, even before I read that story, I think a lot of kids are into spaceships and dinosaurs and that kind of stuff. But that Bradbury story had a particular effect on me because I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's actually it's not much of a kid's story, even though it's got a dinosaur in it, right? It's actually fairly adult.
Okay.
And it's kind of grim. It's got this kind of. The ending is very desolate. It's a really a story about loneliness. And I was really struck by that because here I'm in grade school and I'm reading most of the stories in grade school readers, they're aimed at kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had a whole lot of patience for that as a kid.
Okay.
A lot of the stories tended to be preachy. And I think children just kind of naturally... are so used to being, they're preached at a lot. Children
right.
are preached at a lot. So a child can pick up very quickly, I think, when someone's preaching to them, trying to teach them a lesson. And the story's always like a little fable,
yes.
and it's got the sugar-coated lesson at the part. And that just always kind of bored me. As soon as I picked up the lesson,
right,
I lost interest.
You were done.
That story doesn't really have that. It's not some sort of sugar-coated, sweet little story or anything like that. It doesn't have really much of a lesson. It actually has this very kind of adult sensibility about it. And I think that's deliberate. I think Ray Bradbury wasn't writing kid stories. He wasn't deliberately writing
right.
kid stories. He was just writing stories, good stories. And they put this in here. And so it really kind of struck a chord with me because it was so grown up. I thought it was something of a miracle that this book, that the story was actually appeared in this little book.
Right.
It's still on my list of all-time favorite stories. It's probably my top three.
Okay.
And it really had that kind of an impact on me. I think what it did was it kind of helped solidify my tastes. My kind of taste. And so that's what it would do. And of course, I was always into, like I said, spaceships.
Did you get into video games? Did you start doing like more movies, Star Wars, Star Trek?
Oh yeah, I loved video games as a kid. Although, when I'm talking about as a kid, I'm talking about we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s here. So we're talking Atari.
Right.
That was the thing.
Atari 2600.
You bet. Loved
Kaboom.
That 2600. Kaboom. I loved Kaboom.
I did too.
What a great game.
You're just going back and forth. You're
going back and forth. That was one of the Activision games.
Yes.
Loved Kaboom.
Was it River Rampage or River Run or something?
Yeah,
you were going up the river.
That one, and I loved Pitfall.
I had the Pac-Man.
And it was so lame,
it
wasn't
was
it?
It was so terrible. Even the sounds, it was dan, 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 dan. It was terrible.
I remember we were so excited when we heard there was going to be an Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man.
Yes.
And I was so into that. And then a buddy of mine picked it up, because I had to clarify, I never had a 2600, but all my friends did. Okay, so one of my friends picked up the Pac-Man, and we popped it in, and we're looking at it, we're like, seriously? Seriously?
Right.
And we had to, it was difficult. We didn't want to admit the truth to ourselves, but it's like, this kind of sucks.
Yes.
I'm afraid it just does. So.
I remember you could buy Atari 2600 games at 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
When you walked in, they had the big display, and they had all the games for the 2600 there, and it's like, wow.
It was amazing when video games first became popular, where video games would pop up. I mean, they would pop up in the entrances to grocery stores.
Yeah.
You know, I would go walk up to local Safeway, back when they had Safeways.
We have Safeways here.
We have Safeways here. There's no Safeways in Omaha, where I'm from. So,
I don't actually shop at Safeway.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
But there was, right inside the door of Safeway, there was a couple of, there was an Asteroids machine and a Phoenix machine.
We had Mario Brothers and Joust.
Joust, oh, another one of my all-time favorites. I love Joust. I've played that to death. My mother hated that I was popping so much money into these games.
But how long are you in town for?
Actually, I leave tomorrow.
Oh, I was going to say, if you had time, you should go to 1UP.
Where's that?
It's closer to downtown, but it's all retro arcade games.
Oh,
and you
nice.
Can pay a quarter apiece.
A quarter apiece.
Yes.
Just like the good old days.
Just like the good old days.
I sound like such an old man. Yeah. I loved a lot of video games. I spent a lot of time at the arcade. You know, Joust was one of my favorites, and Zaxxon was one of my favorites. I loved Tempest. I was pretty good at that.
I have a story about Tempest I'll tell you out there.
Okay, excellent. And Dragon's Lair was a game.
Oh, yes.
That was,
I remember Dragon's Lair.
There were, you know, a lot of the games I'd play, and I'd have a lot of enthusiasm for, but a lot of them I wasn't very good at. Dragon's Lair I was good at.
Really? That's the one I could never get past. Like, the first, when he's on the cart, the mining thing, right, and you're having to choose the direction to go, I would always miss it and crash and die and burn, and then it's like, I don't want to put another dollar in this.
The hardest part for me on Dragon's Lair was getting past the Black Knight. This was the guy who, you know, he would tap his, he was on one side of the room, you're on the other, and there's like this, the floor is like a grid in between you, and he would tap his sword on the floor and it would electrify parts of the floor, and you had to jump around to try to figure out how to get forward.
I never even got that far.
Yeah, that was a nightmare. That took me a long, long time to figure out. But I eventually got so good at Dragon's Lair I could draw a crowd playing.
Nice.
So that was like my crowning moment in video games.
Now, we're in a place where they have lots of customizable card games and role-playing games and that kind of stuff. Did you ever get into any of that?
I got into D&D a bit as a kid, but the problem with Dungeons & Dragons that I found is that it was so often geared toward large groups of people. I think a lot of the rules just sort of assumed you had maybe 10 people at least in a room playing. And, you know, where I was growing up, I'd be lucky to have 3 or 4 people. You know, yeah, I'd have the Dungeon Master, maybe 3 or 4 people playing. And so it was hard to find good adventures that were tailored for such a small party.
Right.
So, you know, and if you've ever played D&D, you know, it takes a lot of time to play. You know, that would shoot your
whole
weekend.
It's an evening, it's a day or a weekend, yeah.
I mean, you know, people who would, you know, they'd set aside the entire weekend, they'd spend the night, whatever, and they would play all weekend. I never had that much time, unfortunately.
Now, in high school, my friends and I would play in the library.
Nice. How did you get away with that?
They just liked us. No, we were quiet. We would sit off in the corner and
we would
roll
and dice all the time.
Yeah. And we would actually draw a crowd.
You would?
Yes. People would walk around and they'd be standing around going, what is this? What are they doing? And they would just sit there and watch. And then eventually people would ask if they could play too.
That's
awesome.
And
we said, sure.
That's awesome. I enjoyed it. And when I had a buddy of mine who was the guy who introduced me to it, he would run me through a couple of dungeons. And then he kind of realized, he's like, you know what, Matt? You should be the DM. And I'm like, yeah, I probably should. So he gave me all of his Dungeon Master stuff.
Right.
I still have to this day.
I do too, yeah.
You know, the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Monster Manuals. You know, we're talking about the old stuff before
I got the Compendium.
Do you?
Yep.
Nice. I had all of those. He gave me a bunch of modules. So I had a bunch of, I still have to this day a bunch of the old modules, and was actually looking through them the other day because even though I never got to run anybody through any of those dungeons, like I said, we hardly had time, we didn't have enough people for those,
mm-hmm.
I loved reading them. They were just a lot of fun to read, and they would spark my imagination.
So did that teach you structure and kind of start you on the path of writing your own stories?
You know, I don't know that it taught me structure so much, but you know what did teach me structure, interestingly enough, was movies.
Mm.
And I think actually that's a good way to learn the basics of storytelling. Most of what Hollywood puts out is very story-driven.
Act one, act two, act three.
Yes, and it's very structured and all of that. And, you know, when I was a kid, I'm 10, 11, 12, what have you, and we get cable TV for the first time, and then you have the ability to watch a movie over and over and over again. I really didn't have...
Yeah, 10 times in one night, yeah. For example.
I never had... Truly, you could.
I remember when... what's the science movie where they... Weird Science?
Weird Science.
So when Weird Science came out on cable, it was on every single cable network, every hour.
It was.
Every night for like a month. I just remember turning on the TV and looking at the guide and seeing Weird Science, Weird Science, Weird Science, Weird Science on all the channels.
It was, and that's a very... That is such a politically incorrect movie to watch mm-hmm. now, but oh my God. Yeah, I did. I have to admit, I laughed at it. But you know what? One thing that I did, because like when I was a kid, you know, when you had this was the time of the event movies, you know, Star Wars and Close Encounters and all mm-hmm. of that. And I would go to see these movies and I'd love them, but I didn't have the money or anybody who'd be willing to take me more than once. So I saw Star Wars once in the movie theater. You know, I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind once. In the movie theater.
You never went back to the 50 Cent Theater?
Didn't really have any nearby. And even then, I was kind of notoriously cheap anyway. Mm-hmm. So when we got cable TV, that was my first chance to get to watch movies over and over and over again. And so, like, one that I remember watching a lot was Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
That was on a lot.
Oh, yeah.
In the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And so I got to watch it over and over and over again, enjoyed it, and then I began to realize, the more I watched it, I began to realize nothing that was happening in there, in that movie, was happening by accident. And, okay, we sit there and say, well, duh. Okay, well, it's real easy to say when you're an adult, but when you're a kid, you don't realize that, you know? You don't really understand the underlying story structure that's driving it.
Sure.
And so Wrath of Khan was one of those movies that helped me understand story structure a lot. It's like, oh, this was being planted way up here so that they could pay off way down the road here.
Right.
I began to understand that a bit, and I began to understand a little bit more about plotting. And so I think, like I said, that's a great introductory level lesson in storytelling. And
okay.
So I think I learned a lot.
So you do the Ray Bradbury story. You mm-hmm. start, you're playing the video games.
Mm-hmm.
You start watching the movies and everything. You start reading more books.
Mm-hmm.
What do you start reading?
I read a lot of Stephen King.
Okay.
My parents had actually... I was always an avid reader, which I think I owe to my mother. She was an avid reader, too, during
the... Yeah, mine too.
During the day, you know, after she was... during the afternoon, when she's kind of done with my kind of chores that she would do in the morning, and before it was time to make dinner or whatever, she would sit... And read. She would read with these Reader's Digest condensed books. She used to uh-huh. subscribe to that.
Yeah, my grandma used to read that.
Oh, she just has a... She had a ton mm-hmm. of these things. And so that kind of taught me that this is what you can do with your spare time. You don't have to be watching TV. You can be reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I took to that. So my parents enrolled me in what was called the Weekly Reader Book Club. And I can't remember who did that, if it was a Reader's Digest thing or whatever. But so I would get books all the time. But most of them bored me because they were written for kids and I was more interested in more adult kind of stuff. So then I started reading Stephen King and he was a big influence on me. So I remember reading books like, you know, The Shining before I wasn't even a freshman in high school yet when I read The Shining and when I read Carrie and The Dead Zone, which is still to this day one of my all-time favorite books. So yeah, I became a big Stephen King fan about that time, and pretty much to this day, for Christmas, I tend to get a Stephen King book for Christmas. So whatever's the latest Stephen King book, that's what you get.
The funny thing is, and longtime listeners know this, but I had the opposite reaction.
Yeah?
So I was given the Stephen King book probably around the age of 11 or 12,
mm-hmm.
and because my mom would tell her customers at the bar about her son who liked to read, and so they would bring in books for her. And she would bring them home to me, and so she brought home It. I'm 12 years old, and we didn't have a shower. We had a bathtub, so I'm in the bathtub, and I'm reading It, and the guy in the book is in the bathtub.
That's right, and he kills himself.
And then, and so I quickly closed the book, and then I never read another Stephen King novel again. So, yeah.
There we go. Well, there's at least a sense that it was effective.
Yes.
It had the desired effect. I also read, around that same time was when I read some of your classics in the genre. I remember reading the Foundation Trilogy around that time.
Okay.
And Dune.
Mm-hmm.
I became a huge, huge fan of Frank Herbert. And so, I read a lot of the Dune books.
Did you like the movie?
God, I so wanted to like that movie. I did.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'll tell you how gung-ho I was. We went there, I think, opening night, and I dragged a couple of friends of mine with, and I tried to tell them about it because I was so excited for this movie. And they actually handed out, and when you went into the movie, they handed out this little flyer for you that had definitions of words that were going to be used.
Right.
I even thought that was cool. I was so excited by it. And I went to see the movie, and my friend's reaction was largely one of, huh?
Yeah.
They were just utterly confused. Like, what the hell? I'm like, well... And I would try to make excuses for it. I tried to defend this movie for a long time. I tried to defend Dune. And then I finally looked at the movie again a few more times, and I realized, you know what, this movie is awful. It is awful. Now, there's going to be a lot of people who will vehemently disagree with me on this. I have friends of mine who
Not that many.
There are some.
There's a few, but not that
there's
many.
There's a few. It was awful. And I realized it was just... I hated Dino De Laurentiis for a long time after that, because he produced it, and Rafaela De Laurentiis' daughter directed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a grudge against the De Laurentiis' for a long time.
Did that carry over into Flash Gordon, too? So.
Actually, here we go again. I'm going to upset a lot of people. I liked Flash Gordon, although I will admit it's a guilty pleasure for me.
Mm.
I know it's not a good movie. I realize that. And I find the first, even I, who likes the movie, I find about the first half hour of that movie to be cringe-inducing. It is so bad. But after I get past that part, after I get past that first half hour or so, I really start to like it. And it's got a great cast.
It does. I mean, and it's impressive.
I'm not talking about the leads.
No, like Boltan, for example.
Yeah, you've got Brian Blessed. You've got Max von Sydow.
Yes.
You've got Timothy Dalton.
You've got the future James Bond, yes.
Yes. So what a great cast. And you have the soundtrack, the Queen soundtrack, which rocked,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, I think, okay, like I say, the first half of the movie is pretty bad. And I think a reason that a lot of people have such disdain for it, and don't see any redeeming features in it at all, like I do, is I think it's because it's very campy.
It is.
It is very campy. It's deliberately campy, and I don't think that the people who grew up on Flash Gordon saw Flash Gordon as campy.
Right.
They took him seriously, and I think they were mad that Dino De Laurentiis did not take it seriously. Now,
it's kind of like the third Batman film.
Yes.
When the director decides to go campy and everybody else is going, no, that's not our Batman anymore.
Yeah, and it's exactly the point where I lost. Yeah, that was Joel Schumacher who did that, by the way. I will name names. Oh, yes, I will. That was Joel Schumacher, who I've never been a big fan of anyway. But, yeah, he took it campy, and I stopped right at that point. It's when I stopped watching any of those movies. But the thing is with Flash Gordon... I didn't have any treasured memories of Flash Gordon.
Right,
Dino De Laurentiis was trashing.
Right, neither did I.
So I was able to, enjoy it, even though I knew it was campy. But even then, I like it. I know it's not that good of a movie.
Just for fun, if you like the character of Flash Gordon at all, if you like the story, check out the 90s, early 90s reboot that DC Comics did.
Oh, yeah?
It was a 12-issue miniseries. They cast him as an NBA player. Yeah.
Instead
so
of
they kind of brought it forward, mm-hmm. and they did a NBA, because at the time the NBA was kind of big, and you had the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan and all that kind of stuff. And Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. So they made him an NBA star. And they just did 12 issues, and it was really well done. You know, I really liked it. Anyway, so, okay. Flash Gordon... Dune. Mm-hmm. So you start reading more Stephen King. Do you ever start reading more science fiction other than Foundation? Do you get into other things?
Yeah, I mean, and I was kind of all over the place. I started getting into Lord of the Rings at that time, mm-hmm. too. So I read all of those books and loved them. I got into a little bit of Larry Niven of the Ring World.
Let's fast forward a little bit. I mean, what do you when you're sitting down now to read, what are you picking up? What are you reading?
Well, I'm still reading Stephen King.
Right, you said you get Stephen King every Christmas.
I do.
Luckily, he writes 12 books a year, so you're good to go.
It's more like, unfortunately, he writes 12 books a year, and I'm not hopelessly behind on my Stephen King reading.
I used to get The Far Side every Christmas, but then they don't do it anymore.
I know, it's so sad. I love The Far Side. Stuff that I read these days, I tend to be... still kind of all over the place, and I'll just kind of pick up whatever comes across my transom. I recently read, I mean, just kind of recently got into Name of the Wind, Patrick Rothfuss,
mm-hmm.
Which I enjoyed. I was a bit late. Everybody else was already into it, and everybody else was telling me, you got to read this. It's like, okay, I'll get to it. My to-be-read pile is just... it's become like Mount Everest, and I'm never going to scale it.
So you've seen me at Worldcon. You've seen me. And one of the things that I do is I'll go to the panels that have the authors that I would like to interview sometime in the future, not necessarily right then and there. And I will introduce myself and give them a card and say, you know, I'd love to interview you at some point. If you'd be interested, you know, please shoot me an email, or have your publicist or somebody shoot me an email, depending on how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to one... and Rothfuss was on there, and so I was going to introduce myself to him so that, you know, I could try to get him on the show. And I'm standing there, and I'm taking out my card and everything, and he's talking to someone else, and he can see me out of the corner of his eye, and he's telling the other person that he never takes business cards and doesn't like them and doesn't want people to hand them to them. And I'm like, oh, crap. And I'm putting it back in my pocket. That's my Rothfuss story.
I have a Rothfuss story, too. This was pretty funny. I was in... it was in Reno. It was the WorldCon in Reno.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where I saw him.
Okay. Well, as it turned out, I'll always try to get on programming, mm-hmm. get on panels, sure. and such like that. For whatever reason, I didn't get on any panels at the Reno WorldCon.
I was on both podcasting panels, and that was it.
Were you? Yeah. I mean, I couldn't get on panels, so I was like, you know, I was a little bummed about that. I'll be honest.
We have 650 panels, two podcasting. I'm on both.
Well, at least you got on. No, and I realize, I know that WorldCons are volunteer run, mm-hmm. and you know they do what they can, and so.
Oh, and they work their ass off.
I know that it's a lot of work putting on a WorldCon, so I don't begrudge them any of that. But I had to admit I was a bit disappointed. So, I was chatting with a friend of mine, Carrie Vaughn, who's actually mm-hmm. from the area.
Yep, we know Carrie.
And she and I were chatting a little bit before one of her panels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we decided, I walked with her to her panel, and I wasn't sure I was actually going to sit for the panel or not. I was just kind of like, oh, okay. But anyway, I sit down in the audience, and Carrie goes up there to the panel, and Brandon Sanderson mm-hmm. was also on the panel with her.
Very nice guy.
Very nice guy, yes. And there was supposed to be a third panelist who never showed up. And so Brandon says, well, you know, I think we need to have more panelists for this topic. Are there any other writers out in the audience? And Carrie says, Matt. I said, what? And I'm like, you know, I don't even know that. I haven't studied for it. I usually try to prepare for panels. And I was like, what's the topic again?
Sure.
Something about gods and such. I said, okay, whatever. So... So I go up there. I'm not even supposed to be on this on panel at all. Mm-hmm. I'm on this panel, and then Brandon says, "You know what? I think Pat Rothfuss is free for this hour." And so he texts Rothfuss, mm-hmm. and he shows up a little bit later. So sitting on this panel, we have Carrie Vaughn, Brandon Sanderson, mm-hmm. Patrick Rothfuss, and me.
Yeah.
You know.
And you felt like one of these things is not like the others?
Yeah, exactly. So not like the others. but it actually, for all of that, it was hilarious because the panel went very well. It was a very, there was a lot of great interaction and such, a lot of good discussion. And for days afterward, I've never had this happen with any other panel I've been on. For days afterward, people were coming up to me and saying, "You were great on that panel."
Uh-huh.
Thanks. Totally ad-libbing.
In San Antonio, I was on an urban fantasy panel because mm-hmm. I've written some urban fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm on this panel with Shannon McGuire and a bunch of other people who've all been published under their urban fantasy. None of my urban fantasy has been published yet.
Uh-huh.
So Shannon's moderated. She's going down the line. She's having everyone, you know, introduce themselves. She does her, and then this person, and then she looks at me, and I just looked at the crowd, and I said in the microphone, "My name's Patrick Hester. I write urban fantasy, and all of their editors and agents have rejected me." And got a huge laugh, you know, from the crowd. But yeah, it's like, what do you do?
True. What can you do? But you know, sometimes those work out better than you think they do.
Absolutely. So. To bring it back full circle,
okay.
Right now, what have you got out that people listening to this podcast can go and find and read?
Okay. Right now, you can go out to...
Look, what's your website?
My website, this is a great place to start, actually. Mm-hmm. It's MatthewSRotundo.com.
Spell Rotundo.
R-O-T-U-N-D-O.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No underscores or anything like that. Just run it all together. MatthewSRotundo.com. Alternatively, you can Google my name. The great thing about a last name like Rotundo is it's its own search engine optimization. Mm-hmm. So if you Google Matthew S. Rotundo, I'm like, that first page of results is all me, and my website's right
and
up front.
And a little picture of you on the Iron Throne with the...
A little picture of me on the Iron Throne, yeah, like that. That's actually
rock on.
My Facebook profile picture, or was.
It's your Twitter profile.
It's my Twitter,
sure.
Yeah, it's on my Twitter profile. So yeah, you can go out there, and there's links to my Facebook profile, my Twitter profile, and there's a bibliography out there. So
with links?
With links, absolutely.
Okay, good.
The most recent stuff of mine was a story that appeared in Intergalactic Medicine mm-hmm. Show a few months back, and it's called Wet Work. That was that really dark one I mentioned earlier. It's like one of the darkest things I've ever mm-hmm. written. And there was also a story called Doppler Shift, which is a science fiction story that appeared in an anthology called Launchpad.
Okay.
I attended the Launchpad Astronomy Workshop. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's an astronomy workshop for writers.
Oh, okay.
And it's held on the campus of the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And Mike Brotherton kind of heads it up. And it's a terrific program. It's a week-long workshop. And I think you can still apply for it right now. I think they're taking applications for their current session right now.
Mm-hmm.
For if you are at all interested in helping, you know, learning astronomy to help your writing.
Okay.
Particularly if you're a writer of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily limited to just science fiction writers.
Okay.
It's like, you know, anybody who has an interest in astronomy and you think it can help your writing, it's a wonderful program and I highly recommend it. But they put out, one of the Launchpad alums, Jody Lynn Nye, got the idea to work with Mike Brotherton to put out an anthology of stories by Launchpad alums.
Okay.
And so that's what this is. And there's hope that they might put out more. And it's like some of the proceeds from this will go to benefit Launchpad. So it's a great thing. It's you can find a link to it. You can get it's just an e-anthology, so you can get this as an e-book. You can get it out at Amazon or where have you. Like I say, there's a link to it from my website. The mm-hmm. anthology is called Launchpad, and I have a story in there called Doppler Shift. If you want to find something for me that's not behind a paywall, and a lot of my stuff is behind paywalls. Sorry.
Got to get paid.
It's not my decision, guys. But there's a short story of mine that appeared in the online version of Cosmos magazine. Cosmos is an Australian science magazine. They have they do regularly feature fiction on their website. They also have it in the print edition, but on their website there was a story of mine in there called Fuel, F-U-E-L, which you can get for free. And I think there was a piece of mine that was in Jim Bain's Universe.
Okay.
The late lamented Jim Bain's Universe. And that story was called Kanan. And you can get that, I think it's in the Bain Free Library.
Okay.
If you do some hunting for it. Like I say, there's links on my website to all of that stuff.
Okay. Very cool. Twitter?
Twitter is Matthew S. Rotundo on Twitter and Matthew S. Rotundo on Facebook. You have links to both those profiles from my website.
Okay.
So go ahead and follow me. I'll follow you back.
All right. Any final thing you want to tell our listeners before I let you go?
I just want to reiterate my story that I'm pretty proud of. It's going to be out in Alembical. Again, this is from Paper Golem Books. And it will be out and should be out in early May. This is volume 3 of Alembical. And the story is called From Earth I Have Arisen. And I'm excited for people to read that. I hope people like it.
So. All right. Well, very cool. Thanks for meeting me today at Enchanted Grounds.
Thanks for having me.
Which is a cool little place here in Highland
Ranch.
This
is an awesome little place. I've never been in here before.
It's off the beaten path.
It's very cool.
So. Yeah, it is.
So, you know, anyone who's local should come down here.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.